Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And I hope you enjoy this program, another one Oz-based. These are all the most exciting chefs that we've encountered in a long time. We'll do bang, bang, bang.
Of course, you've met several of them already, but the latest and greatest in Australian restaurant cuisine, going back to the days when we started traveling there back in the late 80s and the year 2000 and beyond, and people gave a label to the group of new chefs who were doing something different.
Mod Oz.
And we called it Mod Oz. In fact, we wrote an article about Mod Oz back then. And several of the chefs you've already met in the last few weeks' programs would certainly belong in the Mod Oz category, but we've kept three very special ones for you. Three guys who are absolutely at the top of their game, and side by side in this program. So, we'll be doing some more Australia in the next couple of weeks. But we'll probably change up and do something different next week. And in the meantime, three of the superstars of Mod Oz in this week's program.
Starting with Scott Pickett.
Who has a restaurant called ESP.
For Estelle by Scott Pickett.
And he'll explain why. And then second up we have
Peter Gunn from Ides.
And he's going to explain that too, yeah. why it's Ides. And finally, Ashley Palmer Watts, who's not even Australian,
but
certainly practicing like one, and running the Dinner by Heston restaurant, which started out as a pop up and now is a permanent part of the Australian and Melbourne dining scene. So that's what's ahead in today's program. So stick with us.
Right.
So anyway, first up
with ESP,
Scott Pickett.
Smart place for a very smart chef, Scott Pickett. This is actually your main restaurant. Is it at your flagship restaurant? But you have a whole fleet of them, don't you?
Yeah, fleet. I don't know if fleet's the right word. I suppose a fleet, a little group, like a couple. So we have the original next door, the original Estelle, which is now the Estelle Bistro. Almost 4 years ago, we opened up St. Crispin on Smith Street, Collingwood. The flagship I could finally afford to build and actually run. So 2 years ago, ESP, or Estelle by Scott Pickett. And then about 6 months ago, I just opened up a little deli at the Queen Victoria Market. It's a chicken shop called Pickett's Deli and Rotisserie.
Now, you are not a Kiwi, which is news. We talk to every chef seems to be a Kiwi transplanted into Australia. You are Australian, born in Melbourne and raised in South Australia. And you've also traveled around. Maybe we could trace this through some of your mentors, because we know these people, and they're really good guys, your mentors. How about tracing your little journeys?
Sure. So I was born in Melbourne, and we lived here till I was about 12 or 13, and my father's actually from South Australia. So we went there on holidays when I was a kid, and we went for a drive into the Southern Vales, down near McLaren Vale, to a little town called Kangarilla, and he was born around the corner in Clarendon. And he was the youngest of six kids, five sisters, and then my dad. And so we went to see his house, like where three of the children were born, and we found a wonderful property, and we decided to move there. So my folks were at the farm for 25 years. So I started cooking over there in a local winery. And then when I finished my apprenticeship, I decided to come back to Melbourne, and I've sort of been in and out of here ever since, really. But in those early days, I worked at the Hotel Windsor, which was a five-star hotel, or is a five-star hotel, the oldest hotel in Melbourne. There used to be a grand dining room there in the early mid-90s that was running for about 30 or 40 years. That it was an unbelievable space, very old-school French, a little bit like, a classic Ducasse restaurant, I suppose, gold leaf ceilings, massive Garadon service. And so after I'd done my time there, then I went to work for my first real mentor, I suppose, in Philippe Michel, who was the protege of Chef Bob Bocuse. And when Bocuse sort of started to really go global in the 80s and 90s, then Philippe was his chef de cuisine in Tokyo, in Hong Kong for a period, in the States, and then finally settled in Melbourne.
Now that you've absorbed all of those influences from him, but you have another Philippe that we are very fond of in London, who was a mentor too?
Yeah, so Philippe and Philip Howard. So, after I'd finished 3 years with Philippe Michel, I was sort of itching to get to Europe, and I wanted to go to London and see fresh truffles and see fresh foie gras and see the game birds and cook at a high level. So I went to the square, and I planned on staying 12 months, and I was with Phil at the square for almost just over 3 years. So crazy experience, crazy time. Both very lovely men, beautiful cooks, real gentlemen of the industry.
Well, just talking, I mean, you have such a high professional ethic. I don't know how else to explain it. You're a real pro. I describe this space, your flagship, as a very smart space. I am intrigued by the decor and the details as well as the overall effect. Can you explain or describe a little bit of this to our listeners, since, they're going to want to come here and see it?
Yeah, of course. ESP was really, it's been in my mind's eye and in my brain for probably, 25 years that I've been in the kitchen, and I designed sort of 90% of it myself. I did. I chose the chairs, the Philip Stark bike from France. I designed the plates. The chairs are Stark. The chairs are Philip Stark.
And what about the plates?
The plates, I've got a good friend in Bali. We go to Bali quite often with the children, sort of once a year, and I've got a really good friend that has a plate store. Like, she makes all ceramics and all different kinds of things. So she made all the plates for me. And then a lot of the new ones we're getting made locally as well now too. But like the knives, when I went on a trip to France and I went to Michel Brar, I went to Laguiole, so all the knives are Laguiole that were specially made for the restaurant. But really here we started with the kitchen, and I wanted my dream kitchen, and it definitely is. There's more copper pans than I've ever seen in my life. And that's what happens when you actually get a chef to design the restaurant. The kitchen's massive and the dining room wasn't very big. So then we actually, when we were just about to open, we realised that 28 seats on the dining room floor wasn't enough. And so then we put people around the counter.
You're a riot. No, you're artistic. I mean, you have a big hanging light fixture, which is really sculpture. Tell us about that.
So we really wanted a central light fitting, and I found a really local designer by the name of Christopher Boots, and I wanted something that represents, at that stage, the three restaurants that I had, my three children, and our wedding rings are fusion by George Jensen, so they're all, they're sort of similar in design. So then, Christopher Boots just did a massive piece in Paris just when we sort of met him about 3 years ago, and he's starting to become quite well known now, but we want to support local sort of artisans and stuff. And he came back with two or three designs, and then in the end I said, look, I'll show you pretty much what I want, and then you design it. So I wanted the rings that talk about life and the full circle of restaurants, my family and my wife.
Oh boy, you're forever amazing. You're an artist, you're a philosopher. What about the food, Scott Pickett?
Well, the food here, look, I'm sort of very fortunate. I've got a wonderful kitchen team. I've got a fantastic head chef by the name of Stephen Nan, who's been with me for about 18 months now. So we work on the menu, and we try and keep it as Australian, in a sense, with modern French techniques, I suppose, as we possibly can. Stevie's probably helped me take the restaurant to the next level over the last sort of 18 months, because obviously I'm a busy man, but his focus and dedication and support is amazing. And you're obviously in town for the top 50 this year, and he's pretty excited because Steve actually worked at 11 Madison Park for a couple of years. So we're all at the awards, and he saw, Daniel Hume and his old chefs and that sort of stuff. We all went on Wednesday night, so it was a pretty special night. But here we try and cook as seasonally as we can, as clean, as precise, but still having flavour and, lots of taste. It's got to be yummy at the end of the day.
My kind of food, I have to tell you. Oh.
Jersey rolls.
My favorite potatoes. Is it the season?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
The season here. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, see, I didn't see that. Oh, they're my favorite things. But anyhow, you started talking a little bit about the event, the 50 deaths, and also the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival. Two things. One, what kind of an atmosphere is there among the chefs in Melbourne itself regularly? And then explain the kind of boost that all these chefs are telling us that they got from this 50 Best here in this event that we just went through.
Sure. Well, look, I mean, Melbourne, even though we're 4.5 million people now, it's pretty much a big country town, especially in the hospitality industry. But I think any sort of major city in the world, the guys at the top level all know each other. I've known Ben and Dan for many, many years. You know, they're both great chefs. They're great cooks. You know, we catch up sort of, you know, not that regularly because most people are in their restaurants all the time and too busy, but at awards or for lunches or for industry sort of things and events sometimes too. But the mood and the feeling in Melbourne for the last 2 weeks has been unbelievable. I mean, we took, you know, there was a couple of us that went on Wednesday night. And the only night that I can actually put it close to is my wedding night. And it's the only night in my life that I've never wanted to end, you know. And it's just, you walk around. It was, you know, for me to hold the event in Melbourne, you know, to have a connection through Steve with 11 Madison Park. And I've eaten there and always appreciated and love sort of Daniel Holmes' food and what they are. You know, to see all the big boys in the world in our city and eating in our restaurants and dining out and then being part of that on a global stage was just... I sort of arrived and I just drifted through for 12 hours. I got there early and I finished late. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow. I mean, I'm really glad that it occurred here because everybody's been raving about it.
Now, you were up to something else, too, though, on a different night of the week. I think it was Saturday night at the House Food and Wine. You were cooking there, too. No, Visit Victoria.
Yeah, Tuesday,
Visit Victoria on Tuesday night. So you were one of the guys serving up there. What did you prepare for us? I've forgotten.
Yeah, so we did the sort of journalist food launch on Tuesday night at the hub of Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, the home base there. So 250 sort of international journalists, and we promoted... The theme was to choose different areas of Melbourne, so we promoted the Queen Victoria Market, where the new deli is, and we did the little rotisserie chicken rolls with the tarragon and kewpie mayonnaise and stuffing, and then the little roast pork jowl, the crispy roast pork jowl on brioche with like a sort of, you know, red coleslaw and stuff. Just great little, I suppose in the States you probably call them little sliders, little burgers, you know?
An evening of eating... He's not complete without an evening of drinking, too. So can you talk to us a little bit about the wine program at all your restaurants?
Sure. That's something that we've really been developing and focusing on for the last sort of probably 2 years. I've got a head sommelier, James Dawson, who's studying for his Masters of Wine at the moment, and a wonderful man that's, you know, very intelligent, got a great palate, and with me building my fifth sort of restaurant at the moment, we're doing a big wood-fired, wood-fueled sort of brasserie into Main Road, South Yarra next year. James is starting to get a sort of wine team together with three or four others, and then they sort of look through, you know, what we have in each venue, what works for each restaurant, but in ESP especially, the wine match is absolutely paramount, so we do wine training sort of every second week, we do tastings, we go through everything, you know, front and back of house, and we always ensure that prior to a dish coming on the menu that we've fully researched it and the wine matches the food.
Now we keep jumping ahead to my major interest here. I'm looking at this menu and I'd like for you to glance through and pick out things you'd recommend for us to eat tonight and just talk a little bit about them so that all those people sitting at home will begin to get hunger pangs and try to figure out how to get a flight to Melbourne tomorrow.
Well, you're lucky. You get to eat all of these things this evening because we're tasting menu restaurant. But some of the highlights at the moment, look, one thing that we always start off with is we like to start off with an assortment of snacks. So one of our signature ones from the start that you'll see this evening is smoked wallaby on black rice. So the And so the wallaby is a very gamey meat, probably similar to venison in a sense, and that's on a black rice cracker. King prawn and brown butter. So Australian local king prawns, brown butter emulsion and shaved macadamia nuts, a little, you know, bit for Australiana. Probably a couple of my favourites in the next sort of group of savoury courses. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 at the moment now, plus the three desserts. You say you like Jersey Royal potatoes, so the boys go to the markets every Saturday morning, and we deal directly with the farmers' markets for a couple of the key dishes. And one of Stevie's great little ones is a Jersey Royal potato with salmon caviar and delicium flowers. It's so simple, but you can taste the dirt and the earth almost that the potatoes are grown in, and there's something special about getting a potato that's out of the dirt only after, you know, 24, 48 hours, and it hasn't been in cold storage, and it's not from the supermarket, it hasn't been kicking around. It sounds funny, but it tastes like a real potato, and it's absolutely stunning. Then, really, the other best one, I suppose, at the moment, the duck and the Wagyu are both fantastic. I'm doing the Wagyu this evening at an event for Melbourne Food and Wine and Festival that I have, slightly different to this, but the Sher Wagyu that's from Ballin, which is in Western Victoria, about an hour and a half from the restaurant. It's probably some of the greatest Wagyu in the country. And on the restaurant now, we serve it with a sort of charred leek puree and a sort of, you know, deep oniony sort of sauce. It's all about the umami and the beef. But tonight I'm doing it, one of our old classics, like a shaved carrots vichy and a fermented Australian truffle sauce, which is just absolutely stunning.
Well, you talk fast, too. Now, anytime I do one of these interviews, I want to make sure I haven't left out anything. Is there something else you would like to convey to our listeners about your restaurant or restaurants, plural?
Look, I suppose the biggest thing is for me that, you know, it's all about the people that we have in the business. It's our sixth birthday next year. We started in the original that's next door, and there was five staff. You know, now we have 110 staff between the four restaurants. By the time we build South Yarra next year, we'll have 200 staff. And that for me, something that I've learnt a lot about and we've really been focusing on the last 2 years is the culture and climate of the business and how there needs to be a synergy between the front of house and the back of house and how important the staff really are too. You know, without them, I'm nothing. I've got great people around me. I've got great sort of key people, you know, in every kitchen that do a wonderful job. You know, they drive it from the front. I sort of, you know, I'm in a very fortunate position these days. I still work 6 days a week and always have and always will, but I run around, you know, checking on everyone during the daytimes and making sure that everyone's okay or, you know, fire spotting or maybe working on a new dish. And then I try to get back to the restaurant at 4:30 and then have dinner with the boys and then we sort of do service every night. So now my daytimes are spent working on the business in the business. And my night times are from 4 till sort of 11 or 12 are spent sort of in the kitchen, you know, helping the boys just dress the food. So, you know, without the great team around me, then we couldn't be doing what we do.
Well, I envision that you're probably a very swell boss because, I mean, you're friendly, you're open, you're empathetic. But you also know exactly what you want and how to explain what that is. And you probably set pretty high standards.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I've got a vision and I'm lucky now that, you know, as the business grows and everything, you know, every dollar that we've ever made in the last 6 years has gone back into the growth of the business, into chairs, into tables, into plates. You know, that's probably one of the differences with a chef owner as opposed to maybe someone that's, you know, more wine focused or just on the floor. I want the guys to have good equipment. I want to have all the little toys myself too. So, you know, I set my margin at what it is and then everything else just keeps building and growing and sort of supporting the business too. So, I have the vision and I'm a very lucky man that I don't, you know, go to work every day. I just wake up and live my life, and my life happens to be the restaurants, and I can do that now. And I'm 27 years in the industry and in the kitchen, and I, you know, really consider myself extremely fortunate to be able to do exactly what I want to do.
Well, we thank you for... We're happy to meet you, and we're happy to experience your restaurant and your style of cooking and observation of how good it can be in Melbourne, Australia, today's food world.
So you've had exposure to all these other people you mentioned, like Daniel and Will, and representing the world of flavor. But when you look back over this week, or when you look back maybe a few weeks from now, what will you think about the impact of the fact that 50 best Westerns in the world just happened to come and land in Melbourne, Australia? So as a result, literally thousands and thousands of people who would never have otherwise thought about coming to this city have actually been through. Is there something special that you think you've sort of learned about yourself? Is there something that Melbourne has learned about itself?
I think that, you know, Victorians and Melburnians have always really rated and appreciated and thought that we do a pretty good job here in the food scene. And what I think we do extremely well is, you know, we're not just great at top-end restaurants or at sort of local places, but everything that we do across the board is of an extremely high standard. It's extremely diverse, it's extremely multicultural, and to have the, you know, the pride in being able to present and actually pull off an event like this on Wednesday night, for me, is actually, you know, it showcases what we do, and it showcases that Melbourne's definitely up there, probably, you know, with London and Paris and New York, and maybe Singapore and Tokyo as one of the top food cities in the world.
Yeah, the funny thing is, and this is not a question as much as just an observation, it's something for us all to watch out for. Last year in New York, which is the first time 50 Best had been outside of London, they actually let the secret out that they were coming to New York at the awards themselves. And then this spring, when they were coming to Melbourne, the people in New York were not exactly thrilled. What they haven't done this year is say anything about where they're going next. Have you heard anything, or are we just, we're all going to have to bite our fingers and wait and see?
I've heard a couple of rumours, but I don't know if I can share them yet or not. But it could possibly be somewhere in South America. Who knows?
That's probably.
But it might.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and next up is Peter Gunn and his restaurant Ides, which is named actually after the date of the month and not the fate of Julius Caesar.
Right. Yeah, Julius might fit in there, but Julius would be happy to dine at this restaurant just as we were.
Yeah, exactly. With a name like Peter Gunn, he should have been some celebrity movie star. But I guess a celebrity chef's about as good, right?
I'm not sure. I could go the movie star role, I think. I've got the looks. Looks for this podcast, anyway.
Well, here we are in Melbourne. And what section is it?
Collingwood,
which is a famous team, I understand. Peter, so it was a rivalry when he lived here. I don't know anything about that. You're... restaurant is called Ides, which is kind of ominous, isn't it?
It is. Well, many years ago, we had a pop-up restaurant, which was held roughly in the middle of each month. So that's how we came to be named Ides. Well, the restaurant came to be named Ides. It's voluntary from the pop-up.
Well, actually, I was thinking not so much by way of Caesar assassinations as I was as our tax returns are due on the 15th of April in the U.S. Anyhow, so here we are, but you are not from here. You are among, like, dozens now of chefs that we've met who are really Kiwis. You're from New Zealand.
I'm from New Zealand.
Can you hold on to that?
I'm from Wellington, New Zealand. New Zealand is very similar to Australia in many ways than you'd think. I think the lifestyle, the cost of living, just the general approach to life and a sort of relaxed mentality when it counts are all very similar. I moved here 2009, it was kind of like a flip of the coin with my friend who still currently lives here, and I either moved to Melbourne or Sydney.
Now, he worked at a very famous restaurant called Attica, which I read somewhere along the line about you that you worked well with that, but you wanted to set out in your own direction. And so tell us how this is a deviation or a variation or a distancing yourself from the Attica. What is, first of all, the Attica concept, and how do you differ from it?
Simply, to me, Attica is a very great Australian restaurant, profiling Australian and native Australian ingredients on a very high end level. During my time at Attica, I was involved quite heavily in the creative process, which required lots of time, lots of conversations with Ben, looking into ingredients, researching those ingredients, which then extended out into growing our own ingredients and produce. During all my time researching, my research and my head would take me to places that I enjoyed a lot more than simply focusing on the native Australian ingredients.
For example,
you know, they're really astringent berries and currants that you can find out in the bush. They're not to my flavor profile. You know, I prefer a lot more sweeter berries, you know, things like mulberries, which are not native to Australia. So for me, in my own personal cooking, I wanted to utilize some of those ingredients. So a lot of the ideas that I was having at the time couldn't actually be inserted into the Attica menu. So amongst other things, that was a major reason for me to want to create some of my own food using these ingredients, hence taking a step out of the restaurant Attica and forming the pop-up.
Well, because you did pop-ups, I wanted to mention those. The Ben you mentioned is Ben Shrewery, is of course the very, very famous celebrity chef. Have you traveled extensively outside of New Zealand, Australia, and this place?
I have not traveled extensively. I don't think my wife has traveled a lot more than me. She's got a life goal to go to 50 countries by the time she's 50. And before she met me, she was really doing a great job at getting to those countries. I think she's at about 30 now, and she's 36. So I haven't traveled to anywhere near that amount of countries, but I have been to Japan, a place that, following some work that I did out in the countryside of Victoria with Dan Hunter at his previous restaurant, the Royal Mail, that work took me to travel to Japan. I really liked the very simple ingredient-focused take that he had, and for me, that's what I believe Japanese cuisine was, which was interesting for me because then I got there and I realized that I wanted more flavor than what I was getting during those travels, and that then took me to like making me realize that America might have that flavor. So I went from traveling to Japan and then ensuring that my next trip to my next food destination was America, in which I went to San Francisco and Chicago and America and New York, and went to all these new American style restaurants, which I very, very, very much like. Then I went through Europe and went through France and done all those Nordic countries and all those great Nordic restaurants as well. So, in trying to sync up with my wife's goal of getting to these countries, I'm trying to get to the restaurants, you know, the restaurants that house these, that are in these countries.
And so all of this has modified your initial style of cooking. You like simple, but you like more flavor. What else?
Well, there's so much that influences my cooking, you know. So what got me into cooking was not actually the food itself to begin with, although now it is very the main goal to being a chef is to produce this delicious food. But during my time at school, I didn't do too well at school. I went from one college and then into what was called a pre-trade college, where rather than studying your usual math and English and stuff like that, we were actually doing trades. So we're focused on three trades once a month, like welding and cooking and baking. And during the time, during the cooking, the cooking classes, I just really enjoyed the processes that were involved, like picking up a knife and chopping an onion. By this stage, I was 16, hadn't done any cooking. It was just, I liked the kitchen. I liked doing these things with my hands that I'd never done before. I liked reading about recipes that I had no idea where they came from or anything like that. So then from that, I realized that was the trade that I was going to focus on, which is the idea of going through this motion of the course. So from that, I then got a job in a... It was windy. It was very hard to find work. There wasn't as many, anywhere near as much restaurants in my small town anyway. I had to take a CV in and sit down and wait for a call back, and they never happened. So I ended up working at a swimming pool cafe. And at the same time, but it was only part-time, the only work that they'd give me, and at the same time working at a Chinese takeaway. And they were both on Saturday and Sunday nights. The cafe was Saturday morning. Then I'd work at the Chinese takeaway on Saturday night, and then I'd work again at the cafe on Sunday morning, and then again on Sunday night at the Chinese takeaway. So I was cramming lots of hours and lots of travel into these 2 days because they were quite far away from each other. And then during that time, I enrolled in a more serious culinary course to really learn basics and get knowledge of and foundations of what was French cooking. And then during that time, halfway through the course, I realized I need to get away from the takeaway and the cafe, which was... They were paying the bills, but that's literally that all they were doing. I wasn't really getting any knowledge from that. So I went on to take the first step, which was doing dishes, where you learn lots about organization. You've got to put these certain plates here and the cutlery there, and then you've got to run them through. They come out the other end, and you've got to pack it away. And that was my real serious introduction to those processes that drew me to cooking in the first place. And then from that, it was little did I know that job that kitchen hand job that I got was actually dubbed as one of the hardest kitchens in Wellington, so the city that I was from. And I didn't know that. Well, I was oblivious. I was like, it's a job, it's money. I feel like I can do it. So I did that for a number of months, and then the opportunity came to work on the larder, which is the colder sections. But rather than just giving me the opportunity, the chef at the time made me work out for it. Well, literally, like, put me through the ringer just in order to get an opportunity to stand at the bench with a knife. It was real tough. You know, they told me, oh, you could come in and do it on Wednesday. And I got all excited and went and bought my first real chef jacket and everything and showed up on the Wednesday. And it felt like, to me at the time, they allowed for me, watched me get changed, and I walked into the kitchen, and then they said to me, we don't need you today. So I turned around and went back out, and I went through many of those sort of mentally challenging obstacles in my first year cooking.
Robert, you seem to at some point have made a really major jump to get into Melbourne at one of the top restaurants in the world. what happened?
Well, I went through that process, and then I wanted to do something more, as I do today. I just really want to do something more. Once I acquire a skill, I like to really hone that skill and then find another skill that I can work on. So the process that led me to working at Attican with Venturi was I found myself leaving that restaurant after a year. As you're told, as a younger chef, do a year here, do a year there, something that I no longer agree with, and I think, and I regret
that
taking that advice from people. But yeah, so during the process, I left there, got into a small tapas restaurant, where I stumbled across this magazine. It was a monthly food service magazine that comes about. In there was this really elaborate dish of, it was lamb and white bait, and I was pretty like confused by it. Like, I hadn't seen anything like that. It was a real modern style of cooking. I'd been, you know, hadn't been doing anything modern. And I asked the guy, I said, what is that? And he's like, oh, that's a chef, Martin Bosley. He's got a restaurant in the Yacht Club, which is a stone's throw away from where I was working already. And I didn't know that there was I didn't even know there was fine dining restaurants, you know. So anyway, a few months later, my time at this place was, and this was again after another year actually, my time at this place was coming to an end, and I needed to find another job. So I made a call just in the paper when, you know, there was no real job websites or anything, and there was a little column in the newspaper. I called this guy. He was driving at the time. He pulled his car over. We had a chat. I said, I'm looking for work, and he said, we're looking for a chef, and that went back for a bit, and then he's like, okay, I'll see you at 9 o'clock, and he gave me the address, and then I hung up the phone, and I was like, shit, I didn't find out where it was. So I called him back, and I said, oh, sorry, what's the name of the restaurant? And then he says, oh, well, it's Martin Bosley's Yacht Club restaurant, which was that magazine, the restaurant in that magazine with that elaborate dish that I was pretty amazed by.
It seems like you had a lot of really advantageous accidental leading down different paths, right? And you are here now, though, in your own restaurant called Ides, and you're executing. How would you describe this menu?
Well, this menu is, I guess it's, all the produce is very local. It's very seasonal. I think, you know, you've got to have a good grasp on the season to create a very special menu. I believe it falls under the umbrella of modern Australian cuisine, although it's not extremely native ingredient. Well, it's not native ingredient focused, referring back to those berries and stuff that I don't really agree with, flavor-wise. But it's at the heart of it, it's a six-course menu. There is an optional course, and we're serving a couple of breads, and then we have one snack to begin with. It's a menu that my team and I can execute in a day, so that we don't do any overnight cooks. We don't do braises for 4 days, and we don't dehydrate multiple chips and stuff. We start every day fresh. We start every day with no rollover. The process begins with the bread, all the sauces, all the purees, everything is made from scratch. All our ingredients arrive on the day for that day. So it's a very raw, straight up flavor focused menu.
How long has this restaurant been opened?
13 months.
Uh-huh. But you're already thinking of the next step?
Oh, no. No. The next step is to... So the one of the first major goals I set for myself in the restaurant was to make it through the year. Doing exactly what I wanted to do in terms of changing the menu. So we aim to change one dish on the menu every 2 weeks. We don't have any... we don't have any space to have a test kitchen, one person to be solely working on a specific thing. So we aim to change one dish every 2 weeks. We upgrade the restaurant furnishings and fittings as they need to be and as we'd like to. So my first major goal was to last 1 year moving at the pace of like light speed, actually, just to get everything, to keep everything constantly moving. And now we only have a lease in this building until 2020, so my major goal now is to make it to the end of that lease.
How about giving our listeners an idea of the food in detail? I mean, you know, they love to hear all the details of the food. I mean, what are some of the things that we'll be eating tonight?
Well, the first course was a snack. It's a wedge of cod lettuce. So there's a beautiful organic cod lettuce that come about an hour away from where we're sitting now. They're dressed with a lemon olive oil that we make from a New South Wales olive oil, some Bonito vinegar, and then seasoned with this very heavy seasoning of Murray River sea salt, palm sugar, black pepper, and there's also some dried chili flakes through there. So the very first thing that you eat is full of flavor. It's very juicy. It's very crunchy. I don't know if it's one of the, I could say it's one of those things that gets you going, yada yada yada, how people say that. I don't really try for that. I just think it's a very tasty way to start this meal. This Moreton Bay bug meat, which comes from comes from Queensland. We sear it, we steam, take the meat out of the shell, sear it in some ginger oil, so it's still only just cooked. Cover it with a spring onion jam, which is a mixture of spring onions and chili oil. Some slices of raw celery, a few more spring onion pieces, a light sesame oil, and then we pour what is a clear pumpkin soup, which we make. It's almost in the style of a chicken broth, but rather than the chicken, it's a mixture of sweet potato and pumpkin.
I mean, I'm getting the impression that you actually are a very strong cook. I mean, I really think you are. You know exactly what flavors you're after. Is this barramundi, is that farmed or wild-caught?
Tonight it's wild-caught. We rotate between the wild-caught and the farmed. So the farmed barramundi is a very, very high-quality product. But when we're
not the same as the wild.
It's not the same as the wild, but also, and when I say we rotate through, is the wild is not always available. There's been tropical cyclones up and down the coast, and we've been fortunate enough to get three fish this week, wild caught. One came today, and we got two earlier in the week for our guests earlier in the week. But that's taken off the. We can serve a nice piece of fillet, season that with allspice, smother it in black garlic, and then we put what we're calling a sweet corn butter, which is some pulsed sweet corn fresh off the cob with the juice squeezed out. We thicken the juice and then fold a ratio of that thickened corn puree, the blitz corn kernels, and butter through it. Pipe that over the fish, and then bake that whole in the oven, all together in the oven, and butter sort of melts over, coats the fish, keeps it nice and moist, and then we season that with a red wine, or dress that, sorry, with a red wine lamb sauce, and it's also seasoned with like orange zest, truffle oil, sea salt.
Well, you're sure making me hungry. It sounds just wonderful, and I'm really looking forward to tasting it all. And, you know, I'm so happy that you found your voice, which I think you have here.
Well, it takes a while, you know. I think we've still got a lot. I believe I've still got a long way to go. You know, after 13 months, well, it's been longer. It's been slightly longer. It's been about 3 years of me cooking my own food with many different plates, many different influences, many different locations even, and you know, when I first started that to current day, the direction of my food has never changed, and neither has the flavor focus. It's just the other things that come along with, you know, creating the inspiration. I'm conscious of the fact that there's many other chefs of a very similar age to me that want to cook complex, creative foods, and with the likes of Instagrams and Facebooks and everything being so available now, it's very important to me to ensure that when I'm getting contributions from the guys, or I'm looking for ideas myself or inspiration myself, that we're not taking the work of others that have tried equally as hard as us. So that forces me to always stay the path of ensuring that my dishes are visually unique to Ides, and that I can hold my head high and say, this is my dish. This is a dish that I have come up with. But, you know, along with all of that, and along with putting your own voice on a plate, comes people that seem to know a lot about food and have their voice to say that this is good and this is not. That's always one of the hardest things for me is now, given some of the successes that we've had, people are not just coming here to just enjoy a night out with friends, which is what I want them to do at the heart of it. They're coming here to critique us, to judge us, to tick us off some unnecessary list, you know. And I can say, look, I've been there and been through those phases of my early career where I go to a restaurant that I know is great, but I don't want them to be great because I'm a competitive chef. But now I'm really happy just to go to a place and really enjoy all the positive things that they do, and it keeps my head above water. It helps me to stay positive, and it helps me to just work harder, you know, by seeing how well other people are doing.
I seem to recall reading that even though you don't value awards necessarily, a few have sort of stuck along the way, like best new chef or best new something or other, and that must make you feel kind of proud, considering from where you came.
Absolutely. I mean, all that stuff is nice. It's just too much of it now to make sense of what's important. It's not what brings people to the restaurant. You know, it's something there's, you know, one of my major achievements was this, was the San Pellegrino Young Chef Pacific Region, yada, yada, yada. But I have suppressed that so much in all my communications with the media and the public that no one even knows now. And I'm very proud of that fact, because there's more to come. There's so much more. We've got a lot more to offer. I've got a lot more growing to do. I've got a lot, I've got a lot more things to be thankful for. You know, like one of my biggest achievements is to have both Raf, my restaurant manager, and Zach, my sous chef, who started this ride with me 3.5 years ago. That's more important to me than any Instagram post from a person that has 600 million people or whatever, or acknowledgement by somebody who's only ever who's only ever been to the restaurant once. But, you know, in saying that, these things do exist, and it's nice to acknowledge them, but it's not worth letting them cloud the decision making and what I am focused on at the end of the day.
Well, listeners, no matter what he says, make sure you remember the name, because you're going to be seeing it a lot. It's Peter Gunn, and the restaurant is Ides. And now,
make sure you come after they turn the light on. But the interesting thing is, you can come by streetcar. You're on Smith Street, which is an interesting street, shall we say, lined with old-fashioned Australian awnings, and coming right down the middle of the street is a tram. And lots of cars, and it's just one of those places. Collingwood is an out-of-the-way place, especially if you're a fan of the classic cats from Geelong, because, as I told Anne earlier on, and listeners, I'll tell you, the most important match in the VFL calendar for both teams was Geelong versus Collingwood, and if Geelong won, it made their season. If Collingwood won, it made their season too. So it's interesting that you would end up here, not exactly Restaurant Row.
Say good night.
Good night, guys. I go for the Bulldogs. I live out west, and the Bulldogs are the current reigning premiers. And I also used to play club rugby, which was, they were, and I played for North Bulldogs. I wasn't very good. I was a bit too small. I grew up with a lot of island boys that just run straight over me. But you know, the colours, the blue and white colours have a near, very near and dear place to my heart. So.
Go the Doggies.
Go the Doggies, yeah.
Okay, and now it's really time to eat. Thanks so much for stepping out of the kitchen to talk to us, Peter.
Thanks.
We're shaking hands on camera, just in case you're wondering this. Thank you so much.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
It was a pretty hard decision to put a guy who has worked with Heston Blumenthal for more than 18 years at the end of a program. But somebody has to be first, somebody has to be last. Ashley Palmer-Watts has a fascinating story to tell about the working relationship that he's had all these years and about what it's like to be responsible for the development of a whole new style of Heston Blumenthal cuisine called Dinner by Heston. And to kick it off in Australia, and we were delighted to meet him and chat with him there. So here's Ashley to close out today's program.
Deja vu, we're in Dinner by Heston yet again, but we are in Melbourne, and we're talking to the executive chef of this place and also the opening chef and executive chef at the Dinner by Heston in London. Ashley, I promised myself that I understood this. Is Ashley Palmer Watts, and you know how I got that? It's all, the last part's all hyphenated. Is the Ashley I know, Palmer, we're called Palmer House in Chicago, and Watts, the Watts riots in Los Angeles. Now that's a funny capitalization of your name.
Yeah, I mean, my name was, I'm actually the first Palmer Watts of my generation, because my dad's name is Watts, and my mum's dad is the Palmer side, and I was the only grandson. So, about, yeah, sure, be about 10 years before my grandfather died, he asked me if I'd take the Palmer name, because I was the only grandson, his name would then finish, right? And at first I didn't. I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. And then I actually, you know, you get a little bit wiser as you get a little bit older and a little bit more mature. And I was like, do you know what? Actually, I'm going to take that on and you know, I'm going to incorporate that into my name so that then his kind of legacy and his, you know, it all moves on. And now I've got my own children. You know, they're the second ones. And, you know, so it's brilliant. So to actually, when you look, you know, back at family trees and stuff, to have actually started something, I think is quite cool, you know.
I agree. and you were quite cool. You did quite a session of the talks, the chef's talks. People were just enthralled by everything you had to say. Why all of a sudden is, I mean, you're suddenly a huge celebrity for some reason here, besides the fact that you're very talented. And you've worked with Heston Blumenthal, who's like, he just got the Lifetime Achievement Award. And I know him, and he's just brilliant. What is it, aside from your association with him, that is your strong point?
Well, I think, you know, firstly, I mean, the masterclass that we did the other day was just a kind of little snapshot into the makeup and the creative process that we go through in looking back at history, using our imagination, and also some pretty high-level techniques and the way we put dishes together that maybe people don't always associate. I know in America you have some, you know, 2- and 3-star restaurants that are, they do some serious numbers, you know, plus 200 in a service, but in the UK and obviously in Australia, there isn't anything really like that that exists. So to get that complexity in the cooking for this many guests, you know, is what makes dinner really unique. And it's not a chore to come here. It should be nice and, you know, nice and relaxed, fun, interesting, stimulating. There's lots of layers behind the cooking. And I think in terms of a strength, it's, you know, I think Heston and I have got a very unique relationship where we've worked together for 18 years.
18?
It'll be 18 years on August the 28th this year. So I joined and there were 5 chefs in the kitchen. We've been through some pretty tough times, pretty tragic times as well, through what we've experienced with a couple of members of our team. And, you know, we've nearly gone out of business a few times. And, you know, all these things, through the good and the bad, we've come through it. And, you know, and it's grown now to, we've got 6 restaurants. We're working on our 7th one. And, yeah, we just have a good time. We're just constantly pushing. And I think we have a common ethos and a common respect. Yes, it's really good, and I'm often questioned on it because it doesn't normally work. Like, that kind of relationship doesn't work for very long. And, you know, I think we both work very hard at it, you know, and sometimes we don't see each other for a long time and don't interact for a long time because of business takes us off here and there, but there's that trust in what we're doing. And so I think when you put the effort in, the relationship stays quite good, you know.
You know, I'm not sure where all these 7 restaurants are. Could you just run through them, like, quickly? And then I want to ask you about the concept of Dinner by Heston.
Okay, so the first restaurant that we had is obviously the Fat Duck, which is in Bray. 3 Michelin-star restaurant, 42 covers. So very well known. And then we have a 500-year-old old coaching inn. It's a little bit adjacent to where the Fat Duck is. We're currently renovating it, actually, and introducing a historical hunting lodge lounge bar upstairs, putting this beautiful furniture in, sort of renovating part of the new build of downstairs to make it kind of really tie into the whole historic building. Then we've got the Crown, which is also in Bray, which is our village pub.
Oh, that one.
Really, really small. It's got big beer garden. It has pub quizzes and, you know, that kind of thing. Burgers, fish and chips, but done really, really nicely. And then we have an airport restaurant called the Perfectionist Cafe at Heathrow Terminal 2.
Okay.
Which we serve anywhere up to about 1,500 people a day. And it's kind of fantastic food fast. So it's the best fish and chips, the best burger, the true Naples pizza, wood-fired oven in there. And then we've got Dinner by Heston in London, in Knightsbridge. And then, obviously, the one we're sat in today here. And we're just about to hopefully sign our next one, which will be in the Middle East. So, quite exciting.
Hey, you have enough going back and forth between Australia. And what are you going to do about the Middle East post?
Well, it actually works out that it's actually on the way, you know. So it makes sense at the moment. But I have a little team that is in between both restaurants as well. So, you know, it will come to a point where I'm not the only one traveling between all the restaurants. As we grow, we kind of all grow with it. So, you know, it's not for a year and a half, 2 years it won't open, but it's another big one. You know, we'd rather do quality over quantity any day.
Let's go back to the original concept of Dinner by Heston. I don't know. I mean, Fat Duck is so well known. I don't know that we need to go over that information. I mean, it is an historic restaurant and a landmark restaurant, shall we say. But Dinner by Heston was the first one outside of the box for Heston in London, and it had one of his fascinations involved with it, history. Explain the concept.
Yeah, so it's based around historical British cooking, looking back at old manuscripts, working with food historians at Hampton Court Palace, which is really relevant for food history in the UK. We have other historians in London, the National Library, which is a treasure trove of the most incredible manuscripts, you know, going back to 1390. And we have access to those, and you know, we have a curator friend that takes us through various things, and all the really old stuff has to be minded by them personally at all times. And so we're pretty fortunate to be able to access these things. And we look back and we read snippets of information, old banquets, old dishes, flavor combinations, how things were put together, so that we can then absorb that and then kind of reimagine that into something that would work in, you know, 2017. It's interesting. It's based around, you know, the best quality ingredients you can get. It's historically inspired. It's clever. It's very pure. We focus a lot on flavor and execution of the cooking. And some things seem really, really simple, but in fact there's a lot of complexity behind the simplicity. And I think that's what makes dinner. You can come in for steak and chips, or you can come in for, you know, powdered duck with grilled red cabbage, pickled cherries and beetroot. You know, it can be different things for different people, and I think that unique mix is what makes dinner so comfortable. It can be different things on different nights of the week for different people.
So basically, well, we've eaten in London, but we're now about to eat in Melbourne. How is this one different? I mean, you're obviously going to be using probably Australian ingredients. Tell us the difference.
Well, I think the major differences are the ingredients. Some of the ingredients you can't get in the UK and some you can. So dishes kind of change through absorbing different ingredients into dishes within the framework of the dish. You've also then got the added complication of, you know, we're in autumn here in Australia, and in the UK we're just coming into spring. So two very different times, you know, and that took a little bit of getting our head round when we first opened the restaurant. And so I think, you know, there's dishes here that are Australian, that incorporate the Australian history. So for example, on the rice and flesh, which you may have had in the UK, here we use a lightly curried kangaroo tail instead of the oxtail. Which is, it's just the same, but it's different, you know. We have a marron and cucumber soup, which is really, really delicious. And we grill these marrons from Western Australia over charcoal and little wood chips. And what else should you try? Obviously, the meat fruit is an absolute favorite on the menu. But again, even the ingredients down to the chicken livers are different here. It is a different, we've had to adjust the recipes, and we call that a process of localizing a recipe. So you can take the same recipe, do it in a different country, and it will come out completely different. So you have to then use your kind of your skill and your judgment, and, you know, trust your judgment on how to adjust recipes to suit the produce that's here. The fish are completely different here. You know, they take a lot more cooking, a lot higher temperatures than we do in the UK. They're not as delicate as the UK. So we've just put a dish on called, I think it'll be groper tonight, with green sauce, which is the one that I demoed at the thing. So you really should have that tonight. You should try that, even if it's a little small middle course or something. But and then we've got a couple of desserts that are based on Australian history. And one is Vegemite ice cream. So it's one of those things where, you know, we wanted to take something that was so Australian. It means a lot to a lot of Australians. And so, but what we've done, when you dilute the Vegemite, it's not like what you taste when you put it on your toast or your crumpet. It's very malty, it's very hoppy, it's yeasty, salty. We get a slight caramel note to it. So what we've done is we've just extended that out into a dessert, and the ice cream is very, very, it's very, very, what's the word, subtle. But everyone thinks it's Vegemite as a flavor that just punches you in the face. This is a different usage for it, so you must try that tonight. The other one, which has got an amazing story, is they have a chocolate bar here in Australia called the Cherry Ripe Bar. And on paper, it looks like it's going to be disgusting. And you can buy one at the airport, at the shop. It's really Australian. And they're really, really nice. So it's chocolate, and inside is a mixture of coconut with a bit of almond essence and cherry puree. So it sounds not great, but actually, they're pretty good. I've got to say, they're pretty good. I was surprised. And we worked with a food historian in Adelaide called Barbara Santich, and she said, if there's one thing you've got to do something based on the Cherry Ripe Bar. So we're like, right, okay, cool. So obviously there's a bit of trademark law here, in infringement with calling it the Cherry Ripe Bar. So we started looking into how we're going to find a name for our version. We haven't just made a Cherry Ripe, we've used it as inspiration, turned it into a really... an amazing dessert based around the flavor molecule that you find in cherry stones and almonds and the benzaldehyde, right? And mix that with chocolate and sour cherries. And yeah, and so we were looking back at history, and the Mac Robinson family that are based here in Melbourne at the time, a confectionery company, invented this Cherry Ripe Bar. And when we looked into the name of it, we discovered that there was a poet that was born in 1590 in the UK. His name was Robert Herrick. And in around 1640, he wrote a piece of poetry called Cherry Isle. And there's an excerpt in the poem that references cherry ripe, cherry ripe, cherry ripe within the context of a cherry isle. And so we took that as... kind of the inspiration, and we call ours the Cherry Isle Bar, because the name that they were inspired by came from this piece of poetry written by a British poet.
Well, you know, this is the great experience of, you pull back one layer, there's something else interesting, and it's a truly amazing group that works on this restaurant and on these concepts, and I'm so happy to meet you, because you're key to all this too, and I had never met you before.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, you know, I've got some incredible guys within the team. You know, the guys that are here day in, day out, running the operations, you know, front of house, in the bar, the guys in the kitchen. We have the same in London, and then we have a small group of people, and you know, I have one guy that worked with me for probably about 12 years, and this is when, you know, myself and Heston were in the Fat Duck. I was the head chef, and Heston was there every day, and a guy called Tom, and he's kind of like my right-hand man. He's like my Ash to Heston. He's Tom to Ash, if that makes sense. So, I've got a most incredible pastry chef that is based in London, but he works on the development for both restaurants. And, you know, it's about shared ethos, shared drive, you know, just brilliant people. And I think people often ask, what's the most rewarding part of your kind of role? And it's not really a job, it's not work what we do, it's what we do, you know? And I always say that if I was to go into the kitchen there, or I'm sitting here, or I'm actually having dinner tonight as well with some friends, when I'm sitting there or I'm standing in the kitchen and I'm watching these guys run a kitchen, run a floor, give an experience to guests that is something magical. When you are not doing it yourself, you are just observing, almost like you're not there, but you are. It's truly magical.
Well, give me a wave when you're having dinner and you've got to tell us what we're supposed to eat. You told us part of that. It's been great meeting you, Ashley. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Lovely to meet you too.
So there you have it, another day, another dollar, as they say, another on-the-menu program. And, of course, same time, same place next week, there'll be another one. So we hope you'll join us then. And in the meantime...
Bye-bye.